It's time once again for Don't Pass Me By with your host, Bob Willis, and we're here on the Shake and Wake Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking to author, journalist, and Beatle pundit, Patricia Stenman. She has an excellent book called Diary of a Beatle Maniac, My Secret Marriage to Paul McCartney. No, I kid. It's called Patricia Stenman, Diary of a Beatle Maniac, A Fab Insider's Look at the Beatles Era. And it's published by Cynren Press. That's spelled with a C, Cynren Press, published over there in Malvern, Pennsylvania. But our esteemed author and guest actually had an incredible career anyone would be envious of in that field, where she was working over in Europe for some major players. So, welcome, Patricia. And could you tell us about how you got your start in journalism and how that developed?
Well, thank you, Bob, and thank you for inviting me today. And yeah, I have kind of a strange background in journalism. The Beatles actually launched my journalism career when I wanted to see them in Philly in '64, and I needed a press pass for their press conference. So I called a little newspaper in my neighborhood in Southwest Philly, and I said, "Can I get a press pass?" And they said, "Well, we don't have press passes." And the editor talked to me a while. I was 14, and she said, "You know, would you like to write a little column for us about teenagers?" And that little column, of course, I didn't get paid for, but it was called Teen to Teen, and I wrote it from the time I was 14 until I was way into college, and it launched my journalism career. And I actually wrote a lot about the Beatles in that little weekly column. As well as different rock groups, fashion, music, you know, whatever, all kinds of things for teenagers back then. So that's how I really launched my journalism career with the Beatles, actually. And then I worked for the Philadelphia Evening and Sunday Bulletin, which was the biggest daily, one of the two biggest dailies in Philadelphia after college. And then I went on to Europe for grad school, and I worked as a freelance journalist, and I interviewed people like the Swedish King and actress Liv Ullmann and actually Audrey Hepburn at a press conference. So I went on to have a fun career there for many years in Sweden and in Finland as a journalist, and I actually lived over there for almost 24 years and worked as a journalist.
Well, that is extremely impressive, and it just seems like there was some serendipity involved there. This lady who you called and asked for a press pass must have heard something in your voice, and to get you to write the column and to be on the paper for several years. What a wonderful thing. It almost looks like somebody was looking down on you from above with that one.
Oh, I believe that 1,000,000,000%. Things just kind of, you know, fell into place. I learned my trade at this little newspaper, and then I went to, you know, journalism school at the university and worked for a big paper, and it was what I did, you know, most of my adult life. So I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the ride.
Well, we've been enjoying reading your book and your other works, and that's an incredible story. So now you're in Philadelphia, you're growing up. You have, definitely talents that are leaning towards the literary. And when did you first come into awareness of these Beatles, on television or the radio, or how did you learn they were Beatles?
Okay, well, I was the right age. I was just about 14. And in December of 1963, our country was in kind of a very sad period after the assassination of our president, John Kennedy. So things were very quiet. I was a freshman in high school. And around Christmas time in the newspaper, on the Sunday paper, there was an article and photos of this group called the Beatles, and in England, it was black and white photos of one of their concerts, and it kind of interests me. But you know, I didn't think too much of it. Right after Christmas, there was a very popular Friday night TV show at that time called Jack Paar. He was an entertainer, actually a commentator, and he had been over to England for something else for his TV show, and he had taken a little snippet of a Beatles concert, and it actually, he had it appear on his Friday night television show early in January 64, introducing the Beatles to the American public on TV. And I saw that and I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. That's the second time I've heard about this group. And of course, the hype came right after that on radio, because in those days, we had no internet, we had no Wi-Fi. We teenagers had radio. And the radio stations and the disc jockeys were our lifelines to the outside world of entertainment, of music, of what records were number one, with the different entertainers and the people were doing out there that were in the entertainment business and the record business. So they started in January on, there was a couple stations in Philly, WIBG was one of the leading stations. They started talking about the Beatles and the Beatles that were coming to New York on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it was a lot of hype. There was a lot of interest in it that was built up on radio. They started playing some of their early songs. So we all tuned in, you know, on February 9th to see them on Ed Sullivan on that wonderful Sunday night on our little black and white TVs. And that's how we were really formally introduced to them.
Now, did any of these Beatles stand out to you as being a favorite right off, or did that come later, or how did that come about? Who was your favorite?
Okay, well, I have to tell you this, that from what I understand with all my little friends back there at age 14, back in the old days, we almost all picked our favorite Beatle watching the Ed Sullivan Show that night. And I picked Paul. And 58 years later, it's still Sir Paul.
Now, what was it about Paul? I understand the ladies fancy him as a handsome gentleman. But what do you like about Paul? What are his characteristics and his music that jump out at you?
I loved his eyes, and I loved his smile, and I loved his voice. And you can go on from there.
Okay, fair enough. Now, what do you like about – we usually bring up Paul because you like him so much, but what do you like about the other Beatles too? We don't usually ask you that.
Oh, gosh. Each one of them was so individual, and that individuality kind of stood out. You know, John was kind of like the leader. You could see that. He was always thinking. He had his thinking cap on all the time. And he was handsome, too. I thought George was so sweet because he was the youngest. And he, you know, he was always eager to do so many great things with the guitar. He was a real entertainer. But, of course, he was the youngest one, and he was cute. And Ringo, I think Ringo held the whole thing together, you know, with his drums and his kind of charming little sly smile in those eyes of his. So they all had wonderful attributes that they brought to the group. And you know, as you read in so many books, each one of them brought their own individuality to the Beatles and made the Beatles what they were and are today.
Now, I understand that you're one of the fortunate people who can say that they have seen the Beatles live, in concert, in person. How exciting is that? And you didn't just see them once, as I say. You've seen them several times. So I know that it's evolved over time to the shows Paul are playing today, which are quite different. But you really know your stuff on this. But can we start off by asking, can you tell us about the shows that you attended with your friends in person and your adventures traveling to see them?
Okay. It's quite a story because I was there three times to see them together as Beatles. And since then, of course, I've seen individual Beatles many times, including Paul McCartney this summer outside of Dallas. But the first time I actually saw them, I saw them actually three times. First was on September 2nd, 1964, in Philadelphia, my hometown. It was their first North American tour. then after that, I'll talk about 1966, where I saw them twice, including Shea, 66. But the first time was their first American tour just 58 years ago on September 2nd, which just passed. And they appeared at Philadelphia Convention Hall, which was called the Old Civic Center. The tour took place from August 19th to September 20th. They hit 32 different places, 32 cities. And it really started a little bit earlier because as all Beatle fans, and I was a dyed-in-the-wool Beatle maniac by then, by September of that year, we tried to meet them. We all wanted to meet them. And of course, you know, I was just an innocent little 14-year-old. But my friends and I had written a plan. I had typed up a whole plan, which is in my book. It's a typed out memo plan outlining how to meet the Beatles. And I wanted my girlfriends and I to get a hotel room at the Warwick Hotel in Philly, which we thought they would stay at. And we were going to dress in our candy stripers uniforms and pretend we were chambermaids and go into their room.
That was my plan, too. No, I kid.
Yeah, I kid. You were going to get dressed up, too, in your costume, huh?
My famous chambermaid outfit.
The famous chambermaid's outfits, yes. But, of course, this never happened. I could not even imagine my mother letting me stay at a hotel one night by myself at 14. But we had this plan, you see. And, of course, it never came to fruition, but we had this plan. And also, the other plan was, and what all these Beatle maniacs did, is, okay, we're going to go outside the convention hall, and we're going to wait to see when they pull in to convention hall and see them. Well, we tried that. My girlfriend Kathy and I were out at convention hall at 9 o'clock in the morning. Of the day, it was actually a Wednesday. We didn't start school yet. We were there waiting in back of convention hall before the barriers and the barricades went up with the police. And we waited about 4 or 5 hours in back of convention hall, the back entrance. And then we needed to go to the bathroom. So we said, okay, we'll slip out and we'll go to the bathroom, which was across the street one of the big hospitals, and then we'll come back. But little did we know, when we came back around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, there were so many police around Philadelphia Convention Hall. There were so many girls, young girls, waiting, and there were barricades all around the convention hall. So we couldn't get back to our little perch, our hideout perch, after we took our bathroom break. And I snapped pictures during that time with my Instamatic camera. And some of those are in my book of the girls waiting outside and the girls with their big posters of Ringo. And it was pretty exciting. So that day passed, and then I ran home on the trolley car. And I ran back to convention hall that evening with my girlfriend. And the convention, it was a very interesting concert because it was not like concerts that you would see today at all. I mean, like light years away from it. It was inside a convention center, which meant that there were actually no stadium seating. There was just rows of wooden chairs, wooden folding chairs. I was actually downstairs in the center orchestra area, which was called EU3. I was in the section E, and I guess it was row U and three, seat three. And it was a folding wooden chair. So when the girls came in, and the other groups came first, I'll talk about those. But I wanted to say that it was very dangerous because we all stood on those single wooden chairs, and many of the chairs fell over, and my girlfriend cut her leg on it because, you know, it was unstable. We were unstable, but it was unstable. And the other part of this concert that was different than any of the other concerts that came, you know, years after, is that because it was a convention center, the acoustics were horrible, and they weren't used to having rock groups there, just, you know, basketball games and things of that sort, graduations. So the acoustics were horrible. You really couldn't hear hardly anything of the concert, and you couldn't see anything. It was dark. It was not even lit right. So it was, in fact, I took pictures inside, and it was almost looked like it was dark except for this little stage. You could barely see anything. So it was kind of a disappointment. There were some other groups on the bill that came before, and there was a Bill Black combo, a group called the Exciters, Clarence Frogman Henry, I remember him, and Jackie.
Is that his given name, or was he Frogman, baptized Frogman?
Yes, Frogman. Frogman. They called him the Frogman. And then Jackie DeShannon was on the bill also. And one thing that was interesting here is the Frogman had just started when the tour hit Philly, because the Righteous Brothers quit. They didn't like the fact that they weren't getting any attention, and people were, you know, not paying attention to them when they were on the stage. They were all screaming for the Beatles. So the Righteous Brothers quit before Philadelphia, and Frogman took their place. So.
That sounds funny. Frogman replaced Righteous Brothers.
That's absolutely true. That's right. Well, there were actually 12 songs were in the set that night. I couldn't hear them much, but there were. I could see Ringo a little bit on his drum kit in the back. That was about it, because all the girls were standing on chairs or falling off of chairs. The first standard song set, which they kept a lot for that tour, was Twist and Shout. That was first. Then You Can't Do That, All My Loving, She Loves You, of course, Things We Said Today, Roll Over Beethoven, Can't Buy Me Love, If I Fell, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Boys, that was Ringo, A Hard Day's Night, and last but not least, Long Tall Sally. So that was the standard song set, and there were 12. The tickets for the concert were, and you're going to sit on this one after knowing how much the McCartney tickets cost. The tickets were from $2.50 to $5.
Wow.
If that's funny, I think I paid $3 for mine with city tax.
And what are ball seats today, like 2,500 to 5,000?
Well, yeah, when I looked for the Paul tickets this spring, they were supposed to start at about 250, but they really started about 500. And
Jiminy, Christmas, $500, wow.
But the first 12, 14 rows in about 2 hours were up to $5,000.
I don't even know how to comment on that. Well, things have changed, hey? Wow.
They have, and I heard that Bruce Springsteen's concert that's coming up, his concerts are doing the same thing with the tickets, the same kind of prices. So
that is daunting.
Yeah. one other thing I wanted to mention is that the Beatles were introduced by on stage by the disc jockey in Philly.
Let me guess, is this your friend? The famous High Lit?
Yes, High Lit from Philadelphia, WIBG station. He was a leading disc jockey in Philly for a long time. And he actually went to New York City. I interviewed him for my book. The interview is in my book. And he went to New York City earlier that year to try to get the Beatles into Philly for the first North American tour. So he was kind of responsible for that. He introduced them on stage, and he told me a story that they came from Atlantic City, New Jersey, from a concert there, and they got to Philly in what was called a Hackney's Fish Truck. They came to Convention Hall in a fish truck, so the fans wouldn't mob them. and the fish truck pulled on the back.
Did the fish truck have fish in it, or was it cleaned out, or what happened?
I hope it was cleaned out, but it might have been a smelly ride for the hour that they had in that truck. I'm not sure. But one of the funny stories that I have heard from High Lit about after the concert, I've heard it's not true, but he told this to me. He said that there was such mobs outside of Convention Hall, and they didn't want to put them in a hotel. So the Beatles actually stayed overnight at his house in the suburbs with his wife and kids. Now, he told me this, but historians have said no. The Beatles immediately left town after the concert by car. So this is quite interesting to see what's the real story on where the Beatles stayed the night after they played Philly, you know?
Do you know who might know the answer to that question if I have my timeline correct from what you said? Was the first tour, our friend Ivor Davis would have been on the whole tour.
Yes.
Them. So we'll have to call Ivor Davis and have to check on that.
I think we should check on it. I have a feeling that High was sort of embellishing the story because he liked to tell little tales sometimes. But it probably would be interesting to hear it from, the horse's mouth there to see where they stayed after Philly on September 2nd.
I am going to find out and ask our friend Ivor.
Good. Thank you. We'll get that settled for once and all. Okay.
Yes. So we know that they may have stayed at High Lit's house. And now please continue. I know you've seen them three total times.
Okay.
So please continue with your presentation.
Well, of course, we were Beatle fans for the next years and did everything that Beatle maniacs did and throw birthday parties for them and try to call Liverpool and all kinds of fun things, burn a voodoo doll for Jane Asher. I mean, we did it all. But the next time I got to see them was 66 when they did their summer 1966 third and final concert tour of North America. Now, I missed 65 in New York at Shea Stadium. They didn't play Philly in 65, so I didn't see them in 65 in Philly. Why I missed Shea Stadium in 65, I don't remember. I think it was probably because the tickets were hard to come by for Shea in 65. At least that's what my friend Pat Mancuso told me. So maybe that's why I didn't see them in 65. But twice in 66, for that third and final concert tour, I saw them. The tour was from August 12th to August 29th, 1966. The number of shows they did across North America was 18. Actually, that was 56 years ago. On August 16th, 1966, I saw them again. It was a Tuesday. I saw them again in Philadelphia at JFK Stadium, which was a football stadium. And actually, Kennedy had been to that football stadium to see the Army-Navy game. He was at the Army-Navy game there right before he died. And they renamed the stadium JFK because everything was renamed JFK in those days. Actually in section WH, row 21, seat 20. Now,
did you save your stubs?
Yes, I do.
Ooh,
I have a picture.
That's really cool.
I have a picture of all my stubs and me. The first one in Philly, they ripped in half. So I only have half of the ticket. But this one and the one at Shea, I have the whole tickets. So I have three tickets, and I keep them close to my heart.
At Shea, how did you keep an unripped ticket? How did you get that?
They did not rip them. They did not rip the Shea, no. And they did not rip the JFK Stadium one in 66. But in 64, they ripped the ticket in half at Convention Hall. So I only have half.
Well, I know when I went to Met games at Shea Stadium, they wouldn't give you that opportunity to not rip your ticket stub. I would have liked that, but they always ripped them in half. So you were very fortunate. What a
You know, I've seen some other tickets in memorabilia books and stuff from Shea 66, and they weren't ripped either. So maybe there was some kind of something, because they were cute tickets. They had the four heads of the Beatles on them, like really cute. So maybe they decided not to rip those because people wanted to keep them. I don't know. But I have whole tickets for those two. But the first one I went to in 66 was JFK. And JFK was interesting, as all these last group of concerts were, because it wasn't sold out. None of these were sold out in this last tour because, as you recall through Beatle history, John Lennon had opened his mouth about being bigger than Jesus or whatever. And
that didn't go over too well.
No, it did not go. It didn't go over in the South, and it didn't go over in the North either, because we had only 20,000 people at JFK Stadium, and that seated 60,000. Okay. And it was an open stadium. It was a football stadium. So there were like 40,000 seats left, which is very strange for a Beatle concert.
For a Beatles, that's sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I was surprised it was a little bit empty up there. But, you know, what could you do? And they did have what they called their support acts that day were the Remains, Bobby Hebb, The Circle, and the Ronettes. And, of course, I remember reading many places that the Beatles became very close with the Ronettes. I think especially George Harrison became very close with them. So there was an electrical storm that night. And there were
between the Beatles and the Ronettes, or in general?
Right. In general, Bob. There was actually an electrical storm brewing, and there was lightning going on during the concert, which is not good. But the rain did hold off somehow for after the concert. They had 11 songs in this set. And if it was If I Needed Someone, Day Tripper, She's a Woman, I Feel Fine, of course, Yesterday, I Want to Be Your Man, there's Ringo, Nowhere Man, Paperback Writer, I'm Down, and I think the last one was I'm Down. Sometimes the last song was Long Tall Sally instead of I'm Down. They wore dark suits. It was very humid that night. I can remember that evening. And I don't remember so much about people rushing the stage. There wasn't that many people rushing the stage. I think in Philly, there wasn't Shea. If I recall, I can say if I can compare the three concerts, these two concerts, which were in 66, there were better acoustics because you had football stadiums. So you had loudspeakers, and they did a lot with the loudspeakers. So you could hear songs, you could hear them. You couldn't do that in Philadelphia at Convention Hall. You couldn't hear anything. Could you see them? Well, you're in a football stadium, so you look down at them, and they're small, but you can see them on a stage, you know, in the middle or on the side. And we all brought our binoculars. We knew, you know, we were going to need binoculars. So we all brought our little binoculars, our folding binoculars.
Were they Beatle binoculars or just binoculars?
Just binoculars, plain old, you know, folding binoculars we put in our handbags so we could see them better. And they did wear dark suits that night in Philly, and it was humid. So, and it didn't rain. So it was an okay concert. It wasn't packed, as I said. There was a lot of free seats, mostly around the top. There were girls screaming, but
get out of here. There were girls screaming in a Beatles show? What was going on that night?
Well, I'm telling you, the screams at Convention Hall in 64 were a lot worse because it was an indoor stadium. I mean, it was an indoor building, so you could hear the screams a lot more than you could at the football stadium, you know, which was outside. But yes, they were screaming, and it was
shocking,
interesting.
And shocked and stunned.
Shocking, just shocked. But the funny part now, of course, is I saw them again 1 week later, which was Tuesday, August 23rd, at Shea Stadium. And you're going to say, wow, Pat, you were 15 or 16, and how did you get to New York City from Philly?
Wow, Pat, you were 15 or 16. How did you get to New York City?
Right. I took the train with my girlfriends that morning, and from Philly to New York, which isn't so long, which about to an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes back then, or whatever. And we spent the day in New York City, which was bad because, you know, all these girls were walking around Central Park and New York City that day before we had to hightail at the Shea Stadium. So, of course, scalpers were out and people who were, trying to steal stuff were, I mean, all these little thieves were out and looking at these crazy.
This was New York, right?
It's New York, and there's a Beatles concert.
Well, there you go. I hail from New York. Nothing out of the ordinary there. That sounds
nothing
like a good day.
Absolutely. So just what happened to me was, to tell a story shortly, is that this guy came up, this old guy, hey, come here, So we went, and we were walking down the street. He had this letterhead and this typed letter, and it was a whole, formal paper. And it said it was a press pass for their press conference later that afternoon, right in Manhattan. And it looked like official stationery, the whole deal. So he said, hey, I'll sell it to you girls for $25, right?
This wasn't Jack Benny trying to make a few dollars, was it?
No, not Jack, no.
I know he was always looking for a buck or two, and he knew Ed Sullivan, so anything was possible. I digress. Please continue. Ignore me.
He was so old, this guy. Well, anyway, we pooled our money together. This was our lunch money or whatever. And we gave him the $25. Make a long story short, we hightailed it down to this address in Manhattan. And there was a guy at the door in this building. And he looked at our paper and he said, yeah, this is legitimate, the guy said at the door, but you can't come in. And we said, well, why? And he says, you need the tickets that go with this piece of paper. So we were swindled out of $25 in New York City before the Shea Stadium concert.
Now, be that as it may, that's terrible that this gentleman did this to you, but the letter was real. Did you save the letter?
I don't have it. I don't have it in my memorabilia. I think probably my girlfriend took it, and she has it, my friend.
As long as one of you have it. I was going to say, oddly enough, that'd probably be quite a memento these days.
Yes, it was an incredible paper, and I think it had their official letterhead on it, the whole thing. And it was real, but he said we had to have the tickets that go with those. So this guy, made a lot of money out there that day. And, we hightailed down. We took the train down to, I guess it was like the elevated, down to Shea Stadium. It was so hot and muggy that night. It was horrendous. I mean, the humidity. The one thing I remember
New York
about
doesn't sound like a charmer between the thieves, the phony letter peddlers,
right?
The humidity. There's really no reason to go to New York other than the Beatles, is there?
Well, the only other thing that killed me was the price of sodas, because we came from Philly, we were used to the price of sodas. I think we paid 56 cents for a big soda, a big Coke. And we were like, we were just gobsmacked. We couldn't believe it was that expensive in New York to buy a Coke, So
I like your choice of words. You were gobsmacked, and before you said you hightailed it.
Yes.
These are excellent illustrative words, the mind of a journalist coming to us. That was very good.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. But I'll just give you a little bit of talk about the concert and close it up here. It was there were 11,000 out of the 55,600 tickets that were not sold. So only 44,600 tickets were sold. So again, the upper rows were kind of empty. I started at 7:30 p.m. I was in the upper reserve section for $5. And it was section 35, row S, seat 12. They did the same standard set of songs, the same 11 songs, except for the last one. They did Long Tall Sally instead of I'm Down. And that just changed the last song. There were lots and lots and lots of big banners in the audience, much more than in Philly. A lot of people had, you know, printed banners that said, "Hey, Paul," or "I love Ringo," or "Come," you know, all that kind of stuff. "Come and see me," whatever. But that I remember, there were so many banners around the whole stadium. And this is when actually I heard, you know, the Beatles had thought that they wanted to stop touring for several reasons. And I read that against the backdrop of all these fans and fewer fans than they've ever seen before on their tours, they said, you know, "I don't think we want to tour anymore." And I also have heard that they did stop touring after this one last tour, which ended on the 29th of August, because they were exhausted. They didn't like the
Let me use my lifeline and call Regis Philbin. Was that show at Candlestick Park?
Candlestick Park. I think it was. Yes, it was. Yes. Yes, it was. That was the last one, Candlestick Park. That's right. And the number of people there was down also.
17, because John made rude remarks. There was only 17 people in the audience. No, I kid.
Right. They also
that included Mal Evans, who set up the stage.
He set it all up, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
They were also worried about their personal safety and well-being. Also, there had been the death of their manager not long before. And John hated touring anymore, and George didn't like it either. And they didn't like the sound quality. They were complaining about things like that. So there were a bunch of reasons why they really stopped touring after this tour, where I was fortunate to see them twice. So, you know, that they also, but one other thing was interesting, they wore their light suits that night instead of the dark suits that they had in Philly. And they had new 100-watt amplifiers, which they thought would make the sound better, which is, I don't know. I thought the sound, you know, was okay because it was much better than the first concert. So that's my story of the three concerts 58 and 56 years ago, my friend.
Well, now, like, it's come full circle. Now, I know you've seen Ringo and Paul. I think the Beatles used to play 27 some odd minutes at their shows, and you went through the usual set list. But what is this McCartney character who makes basically he's leaving with wheelbarrows of money when you go to see the show now, but money, that's what he wants. But that's what all these stars do these days, don't they? But so now what are his shows like? Is the set list comparable to when the Beatles played for the 27 minutes? Or how long does Paul play?
Paul plays for almost 3 hours without a break, okay? He doesn't take a break. He barely takes a drink of water. And he just jumps around the stage like he's, you know, 28 years old. He plays some of the Beatles songs, of course. He plays some of his solo stuff. He plays some of the stuff from Wings. He plays the ukulele. He plays, you know, the piano. He plays the guitar. He is quite a showman. And it was worth every penny of the money I spent to see him this year and 3 years ago and all the other times that I've seen him in concert by himself, you know.
That, and what about the other fellow who used to sit behind the drum kit? Okay. He was left-handed like Paul, Richard Starkey. How is it to go to see Richard Starkey?
Richard Starkey's interesting because, you know, he's a drummer. So you expect that he's on the drums, and he has a couple other famous drummers back there with him, you know, on other drum kits. So he invites different, when I've seen him, he invites different famous drummers up there with him for the show, and he does a good show. And he gets out there in front of the group. He gets off the drum kit. He gets out there in front, gets his microphone, and he sings. And he jumps around the stage. And he is very active for a gentleman who's in his 80s. Very active. He's
all he eats is broccoli, right?
Well, I think so. I think he's a
if
vegan.
All I ate was broccoli, I'd probably jump around too. But being a meat eater, I'm sitting in my Barca lounger.
That's right. But he really puts on a good show, too. His venues are usually smaller than Paul's, which I love because it's a more intimate feeling when you go see Ringo in a smaller, you know, room, or it's not a room, but in a smaller place. So I really enjoy seeing Ringo. And he has not come to my area for some years, but I last time he was here, I saw him. And he'll come through, you know, he'll come through this area every so often out in Texas. So I'm looking forward to seeing him again. Bless him.
Yes. Now, while we have about a quarter of the show left, about 15 minutes, I don't want to wait till the last second for the big important news. Where can people go to look to find your book?
Well, thank you. Where they can go is they can go a few different places. They can go to Amazon. It's on Amazon. And they can also contact me through my website, which is diaryofabeatlemaniac.com. And if you order it through me, of course, I can, you know, I'll sign it for you. And my website's kind of fun. It has a lot of old pictures, and I do a blog and monthly and that sort of thing. And then, of course, you could also purchase it through my publisher, and they are in at CYNREN, and we pronounce it Kinren Press in Malvern, PA, and they also have my book there. So, but I wanted to ask you while we're talking, my friend, when we're talking books, I heard you do have a new book that's going to hatch soon. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, Patricia. Thank you so much for asking spontaneously. I didn't ask you to. My friend Don Jeffries has about 6 published books on other subjects, but he's an old pro. So we got together and we're putting out a book on the Paul is Dead rumors, but we're not saying that Paul is dead. We're just covering the rumors. And the working title is From Strawberry Fields to Abbey Road, the story of Billy Shears. And we're interviewing very interesting Beatle people, such as yourself. You were kind enough to be in there and give an interview. And we have Vera Ramone, who is the married to Dee Dee Ramone from the famous Ramones rock group. We have Lawrence Juber from Wings. We have Ivor Davis. We have Jude Kessler. One of the cow sills, I forget which one, but we love all the cow sills. So I think it's Bob Castle. So we're looking forward to it. And again, some people say, oh, he's not going to say Paul is dead. Is he? Au contraire. No, we're not saying Paul is dead. Paul's still playing, as Patricia just told us about his wonderful shows. We're just cluing you in on that piece of Beatles history. And there's some excellent cover art and back cover art by Warren Brown from our Tomorrow Never Knows podcast. So that's the book, Patricia. Thank you for spontaneously asking about it. Oh. Bear Manor Press will send it. We'll be publishing it.
Well, you're there welcome. I can't wait to get my autographed copy.
We'll send you at least 2, and we'll be sure I'll try to get all the fellas to sign them for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you
now,
so
tell
much.
Tell us about your book's cover, because I think the pictures on there are it looks like a nice poster. It's really a cool cover for your book.
Yeah, well, my book is actually a memoir, and it's a diary that I kept partly from the time I was 13, but Beatlemania hit at 14. And the cover is interesting because I actually was working for this newspaper, daily newspaper in Philadelphia, after I graduated college. And I had an idea for the Sunday magazine editor for a story, and it was in 1974, which was 10 years after Beatlemania hit America. And the idea for the story was actually almost what I based my book on later. The idea for the story was 10 years after Beatlemania, what was it like to be a Beatlemaniac? And the editor, the Sunday magazine editor, said to me, go ahead and write it, the story, and we'll take a picture of you with your memorabilia. And I said, yeah, I still have all my memorabilia. It's at my mom's house. And so they brought it. We had 24 photographers on staff at the Bulletin. And a very great photographer came to my house named Sam Nasella. And he brought his person who sets up everything. They got my memorabilia and they spread it all over my mother and father's recreation room. And I had a high pile orange carpet they did at down the recreation room. They put my posters on the wall. They put my 6-foot picture of Paul McCartney on the wall. They spread out everything. And then they asked me to be in the picture. And they wanted me to wear something that I had worn as a Beatlemaniac. And I had at my parents' house a mini dress. So I put that on. And this is, don't forget, this is 10 years after. I'm a journalist. So I posed with the memorabilia, actually with my head on Paul McCartney's shoulder, the 6-foot poster that I had.
And just like in Hey Jude, you had your head upon his shoulder.
That's right. The head upon my shoulder. That's exactly right. So that was used to illustrate the story that I wrote in the Philadelphia Sunday Bulletin magazine called, and in fact, the whole article is in my book. They published the whole article again. And when I started to get into when I wanted to write this book, and the reason I wanted to write is because I thought Beatlemaniacs should write what they did so we have it as a history in the future. But when we started to talk with my publisher about this book about 5 years ago, and she said, you know, ideas for covers. And I said, I have a beautiful photo of me with my memorabilia. And she used it for the cover. It was a little hard to get the cover because of the, you know, where do I get the print of this thing, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, it is on the cover of my book. And I'm so pleased that Holly used it for my cover because it kind of says it all. That's all I can say, you know.
And tell us more about your book. It's been noted and gotten some real favorable reviews, and I know the fans love it. But it's gotten some pretty nice reviews, hasn't it?
Well, I did get a lot of good reviews, and I had a friend of yours, I think he might have been on your show too, actually do my foreword, Larry Kane, who was a Philadelphia journalist and who was on the first Beatle tour. He's done my foreword of the book. He gave me a really nice foreword. I also was really honored earlier this year because I became the 2022 recipient of the Independent Press Award for my book in the category of arts and entertainment, which was quite an honor. I get to put a little gold sticker on my cover of the book. So that's exciting. And the book actually, as I mentioned, is a first generation fan book. I call myself a vintage Beatlemaniac. And I was, as you know, from what I just said, I was an inner city Philly girl. I was right for the chase at 14. I used my little diary that I kept all those years about Beatle things. I used my scrapbooks because we all kept scrapbooks back then. And this little teenage column that I wrote that I think I told you about. So I've used them all in the book and it's in diary form. My idea was as a journalist, I wanted to explore this era of Beatlemania through my experiences, my personal experiences. And since I documented everything and I kept everything, it was kind of easy for me. And I also had founded a fan club, which all of us girls did back then. I founded one for actor Victor Spinetti from Wales.
Tell us more about Victor. That was going to be my next question. We have about 6 minutes. I think it's his being your friend is so interesting.
Yeah, Victor, we met Victor in September of 64. He appeared in a play in Philly that was pre-tryout to Broadway. A lot of plays try out in Philly, then they go to Broadway. He was in a British play called, it was a musical called Oh, What a Lovely War. I wrote him a letter where I thought he was going to stay at the, I guess it was the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. He got that letter the day he checked in. And he answered me by letter. He had no internet. And he said, please stop up at the stage door with your girlfriends, and I'd love to meet you. So we did. That was in 64 in September. We stopped almost every day after school because our school was really right around the corner. And what happened was that he was so charming to fans. He loved Beatle fans. At that point, he had been in A Hard Day's Night. So all of us Beatle fans knew about him. That's how I knew when he came to, you know, to Philly. I read about it in the newspaper. Oh, we've got to see this man. And he became so friendly and sweet to his fans and to our little group of girls, you know, which I call my Beatle buddies in the book. We decided when he got up to New York, which was like 3 weeks later, and he was at the Broadhurst Theater in New York, we went up there to see him. We took the train at age 14 and a half, and we went to see him, and we wanted to start a fan club for him. And Victor loved his fans, and he loved our little fan club. He had a few fan clubs in the States and in England. To make a long story short, he made, right after he stopped Oh, What a Lovely War, he went and he was chosen to be in the next movie, which was Help, the next Beatle movie. And he starts sending us little gifts from when he was on location, little gifts such as Beatle autographs on a plane menu and things of that sort. A half of it was a cigarette butt that John Lennon smoked, that kind of fun thing. And he did send me some other, send me a birthday card and stuff of that sort on, you know, when it was my birthday. I stayed friends with Victor after the fan club broke up after high school and talked to Victor. I went to see him in London once when I was going to England. And I planned to see him one more time when he got older, when he appeared at the Fest for Beatles Fans in 2006, I believe it was, in Las Vegas. And I spent the whole weekend talking to him, and we had dinners together. And he was just a friend for life. And when he passed in 2012 in Wales, it was a very sad day for me.
Well, he sounds like a wonderful person, a wonderful person of the fans, and you got to know him, and that is wonderful. And I have one more question for you as we close out.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and something that's very special in their library. What is it that I'm thinking of?
Well, I was so excited because the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame asked me to send my book to them for their library and archives. So I am very honored to be. They wanted fan memoirs, and I'm very honored to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this time. It's an honor for me. Thank you for asking.
Well, congratulations on that, and maybe next time you'll come on with your friends, the Beatle Babes. Maybe we could do another one if you guys are willing. It's so cool that you are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We thank you for being here today. This is Bob Wilson for Don't Pass Me By on the Shake and Wake Network. And we thank our buddy Steve for producing and helping me out with my lack of tech expertise. And God bless you all and have a wonderful week till next time.
Thank you.